Good afternoon and welcome here at the lecture hall to one of our Monday presentations. I'm Alexa Sekyra, head of the Scholars Program, and it is my pleasure to introduce one of our postdoc fellows here. Naomi Etienne is specialized on 18th century French art and material culture. She holds a PhD in art history from the University of Geneva in Switzerland and the Sorbonne in Paris. Her research deals with materiality, museum history, links between theory and practice, as well as art, science, and craft. Her first book, The Restoration of Paintings in Paris, 1750 to 1815, was published in 2012. She also edited a series of volumes, including Things Between Worlds and Creating Exoticism and Authenticity in the West. It was published in Material Culture Review in 2014. And History L'Atelier, published in Lyon in 2012. She's now working on the history of anthropological dioramas in the United States at the end of the 19th century, as well as pursuing her research on restoration history in the 18th and 19th centuries. She has taught art history at the University of Geneva, the University of Zurich, and the Institute of Fine Arts, NYU, since 2006, where she also was a Mellon postdoctoral fellow from 2013 to 2015. Also, she co-founded the Eternal Tour Association, which organized the curatorial project between 2008 and 2012, and she is a founding editor of a new online publication, www.journal18.org. Noemi's talk today is titled The Materiality of Dioramas, Art and Craftsmanship in the Contact Zone. So please welcome Noemi.
Okay, thank you very much, Alexa, and thank you very much to all of you for being here today. What I'm going to do today is a real research presentation. I'm not gonna read a paper, but rather I will present some material I'm working on now, and certainly a lot of questions I have. That makes me very eager and happy to hear your thoughts and comments at the end of this presentation. So no big answer, but a lot of questions for sure. And I also must say that this is a side topic somehow of mine, something I've been working in since a couple of months, even years, but no specific principal research project. So I just thought it would be useful to let you know a little bit more about where I am coming from in terms of research. As Alexa just said, I've done most of my scholarship on conservation and restoration history in the 18th century. And I'm very glad to say that the GCI is currently translating this book, as people here knows. So basically, the question in that kind of research were and still are, what do we do with artworks? How do we transform a painting that we receive in the 18th century? And this is where I'm heading to. So something quite different. This is coming from the Getty, as you will recognize. Here I'm interested in, let's say, foreign material culture, Japanese and Chinese material culture, and the way it has been integrated into French furniture and French interiors. So that might seem to be two different topics, but in my mind, some of the questions remain the same. Questions such as, what do you do with things materially? How do you exhibit them? How do you transform them? How do you appropriate them? So I first encountered my new research topic in New York in the Museum of Natural History. This is a picture I took. And I was struck by the display. I just wonder, okay, what is that and what can be said about that? Is there even something to be said by an art historian? And I discovered quite quickly that this display have been invented, let's say, during the second half of the 19th century in order to display material culture and generally material culture from the collection, the museum collection. So somehow I found back my old question about what do you do with things and how do you handle them materially and symbolically. So that's something, I guess, why that's one of the reasons why I've been appealed by that display. But to begin with a more, to begin with the beginning, what is a diorama? So there is no, it's going to be disappointing, but there is no single and simple definition of a diorama. This is where the word is coming from. It has been invented in 1822 by Louis Daguerre, that you know because you have seen the show that is currently at the Getty. And it was meaning, it was coming from the Greek and was supposed to have as an etymological background the expression thing through. Voir à travers. So the first diorama, the first things that were called diorama looked like that. This is a theater, kind of a theater, in which you could enter in Paris in the early 19th century. So basically, you as a visitor could enter it, and you faced an enormous oil painting. It might be a landscape, it might be an interior, and then you had an effect of light change, so from daylight to nighttime. And then a big move, and another painting faced you, and again, the same effect, another painting with another representation, and then again, the same effect from daylight to nighttime. So this kind of display were very popular and spread out somehow. And here, you have a portable version of them. And it's interesting because you can see on the second image the layers, because the effect of light transformation was created by the interposition of multiple layers, making it darker and darker and darker. So this is just a small version that you can relate to, and it's also coming from the Getty collection. In the second half of the 19th century, however, dioramas were used. The word diorama was used in order to describe such displays. That is supposed to be one of the first, not to say the first, habitat group or natural history diorama exhibited in the United States at the end of the 19th century. And it has been made by a taxidermist who's quite famous, whose name is Carl Ackley, and we will come back to the discussion a little bit later. So, another kind of display, not anymore the theatrical representation, but another, but still conserves something of the idea of a lifelikeness somehow, and also deepness. So you had like a painted background, and then stuffed animals, and then kind of a direct view of the landscape. Now, the dioramas I'm interested in are much more like this one. These were displays that have been created first in Europe, mostly in Scandinavia, actually, in order to represent folk art and folk culture of Scandinavian people. It was also very much spread out in Germany and Belgium. And it has been imported, as far as I know, by Franz Boas, who's the German anthropologist that some of you might have heard of, who immigrated to the United States and proposed to reorganize collection in New York and Washington, first in Washington and then in New York, because he was a curator at the American Museum of Natural History. He proposed to reorganize the collection, not, did he say, in an evolutionary perspective, so basically not simply you take one prehistoric knife and then you put a knife coming from Africa, then you put a Native American knife, and finally a contemporary American knife, and you show how linear the evolution was. But as you say, by culture, so basically in order to emphasize the fact that each artifact, each object makes sense in its own culture, so it has to be displayed as a biotope and not as a continuity. Boas left the American Museum of Natural History in New York. He left it quite quickly. But dioramas remained and spread out very much everywhere in the United States and in Europe. This is an example of how dioramas look like in the 1910 and later on. just to make it clear, a painted background, which we didn't have with Boaz, sculptures, generally artifacts from the collection. And for what concern American Native American representation, one must say that the population that were the most represented were people from the Southwest. So Arizona, California, New Mexico, that was the thing. The Hopi, Zuni, Apache, Navajo, these kind of tribes were the ones which were the most commonly represented. First of all, because they were somehow far away in terms of geography, and also because they were perceived as being far away in terms of somehow evolution. Something touching, but something also very far. That it must be said also that this kind of display are not only an American thing. You find them everywhere. You find them in the Middle East. You find them in Egypt. In the 1930s, Egypt created a lot of dioramas representing agricultural population. And you find them not only in museums, but also you find them in fairs and like recreative displays. This is a little bit different in the sense that it's supposed to reenact a historical moment. And this is even more typical. So it's the encounter from the discoverer of America in the Jamestown, Virginia exposition in 1907. So the captain encountered the Indians. Quite, of course, a stereotypic moment. And also, you might think that this was really made only for fairs and recreational moments, but this display has been incorporated after the fair in the Museum of Natural History in Washington. So you had also a big permeability between the spaces. So it is these displays have been criticized heavily, and of course, certainly fairly by a lot of scholars. Here it's interesting because it's a Native American scholar, Richard Hill, who's from Oostuskarora, which is also of interest for us because this is one of the six nations that forms the Iroquois Confederacy. And I'm just going to read it. But the dioramas are in themselves a throwback to the old-style museum that frees Indians in the past. The diorama become a big toy for adults, allowing all to play Indian for a moment in time. While museums forever associate Indians with dioramas containing life-size figures, while museum visitors always expect to see casts of Indians next to the stuffed animals, mechanical dinosaurs, and replicated fauna. So this is a critique that is entirely valid, and I think you can all measure that the strongness of it. That being said, what I will try to do today is to point out the complexity of dioramas and also to put emphasis on our alternative form of them, the one that have been created in Albany. And I argue, or this is at least what I'm convinced of, that they were also, and that's a particular argument, but that they were also sometimes, not often, but still sometimes, sites of representation and of self-representation. So basically, we will see that they were used by Native American communities at the beginning of the 20th century. So as soon as they arrived in the US, they were also used by Native American communities and African American people, but I will not address that today, as a reaction somehow. This is the case of this diorama made in Albany that I will discuss with you today. And they were created by this guy, Arthur Parker, who you might not know because he's not very famous, actually, although he's an important anthropologist from Seneca background, who refused to do his PhD. It's quite funny. He refused to do his PhD with Franz Boas. Boas asked him to go, and he said, no way. And who has had a very interesting and complex career. In the museum, in the New York State Museum, Albany. He's Seneca, and Seneca as Tuscarora are one of the six nations that forms what is called the Iroquois Confederacy. I'll just show you a little map. It's close to New York and Albany. And he worked with these two guys, sculptures, not very famous, I must confess, Henri Marchand, who's a French sculptor, And Kaspar Meyer, who's a German sculptor, and who's an interesting case because he has been invited to work in New York by Boas, so both of them discuss in Germany in German. And Arthur Parker asked Boas, I want to do dioramas myself, can you just recommend me some guy? And he said, yeah, take Arthur Parker, Kaspar Meyer. So the sculptor is working on both sites, in Albany with Arthur Parker and in New York with Franz Boas. Unfortunately, somehow, the dioramas from Parker have not been really studied. Very briefly, they are mentioned because it's a quite sensitive object. So basically, they are briefly mentioned in one of the biography of Parker. And here's what it said. In a very real sense, Parker's life groups were comparable to the taxidermic dioramas of African primates, created from animals that Carl Ackley shot on safari and stuffed for the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Both Ackley's primate and Parker's Indian were frozen in a single realist pose forever, noble specimen caught close to the moment of first encounter. The carefully constructed museum representation of both African primates and Indian people served the same purpose. They testify to the resounding triumph of American civilization. So I think this kind of presentation shows two things. The first one, I agree, is that I am dealing, and she was dealing when she was writing that, with a very, very sensitive history full of loss and dispossession and murders that has a long history here and that still somehow has consequences today. And it's clearly, as a scholar, you need to be very, very careful when you're approaching that. This is something really that must be said. But I disagree with the way she presented the diorama I'm interested in. And the comparison she makes is with this diorama, or this set of dioramas that were created in the 1920s by Carl Ackley, the same taxidermist that we mentioned, and that have been analyzed by Donna Haraway in a very important article in the 1984. And Haraway is really analyzing these displays and really criticizing them in a very strong and very meaningful way, saying, okay, these objects were created by a certain number of people who were sharing the same ideology first, which was based on the search for the best specimen. So basically, you have to know that Carl Ackley killed a lot of gorillas until finding the one he really wanted, the perfect gorillas. So, true story. Haraway said, okay, this eugenic quest has a very, very powerful meaning. And Thuggan, she said, these dioramas are also reflecting somehow a conservative position, being the Edenic paradise that we have lost, the perfect moment before civilization. So her argument is trying to make clear that dioramas have a meaning, which I totally agree, but also that she also unfolds somehow the specific meaning of these dioramas. And this is an analysis that is absolutely brilliant and very strong. But the problem is that this analysis has been used and reused and reused. It's constantly reused, so much so that we don't really see these dioramas anymore, because each time that you have the word dioramas, you have Donna Haraway coming. So basically, I have nothing against the analyze. I have a lot against the kind of systematic use of it for everything. So this is what I try to do. That's really my research tool. I'm trying to create a kind of tools or objects or method or whatever to see again the diorama. So not to just always see them through Haraway's perspective, but to try to make them more visible. And I think there is something here that art historian can do. And it's a very basic thing. I'm going to try to look first, let's put it like that. Look first and criticize perhaps just after. And I think that even postcolonial theory might be very more efficient and somehow accurate if we just start by looking and then go back to the critique in a second time. And that's something I'm working on, so we can discuss it forever. But basically, four entries. The first idea is assemblage, and the fact that objects are put together and that this gathering makes sense, build a history. The second I will not discuss today, but These dioramas are created by meeting of people, models, anthropologists, artists who physically meet. Contact, a lot of these dioramas are created through physical contact between skins and material, between painting and people. And finally, touch has a specific role in these dioramas, not only the one in Albany, but more generally. And I think that it has also something to, that there is also something to be said about time. And I think that it creates some time effect that I'm happy to discuss with you later. I'm still trying to figure out where I'm going. So basically, what I said, first point, putting together so many objects create a story. And I use the word assemblage because it's a contemporary word. Yeah, I'm not saying that this is a diorama, but this is called, this was called assemblage. And I think there is something to be said about the fact that you have plaster figures put in relationship to artifact from Rodin's collection. So this is basically his work and his collection, and he created that kind of encounter. And another point to be also emphasized is that many sculptors who work in the dioramas in the United States have been connected to Rodin, which is quite normal because he was a very famous artist accepting a lot of American students. But there is a high percentage of them. And this is the case of Henri Marchand, who said, I studied with Rodin, and then my career went down a little. A brief note about representation of Native American. I think that's a little bit earlier, but that's a good, I think, example. Even the title, I think it's a piece of art. The Indian, the dying chief contemplating the progress of civilization. So this idea that Native Americans were vanishing was quite commonly repeated in sculpture, but not only. This was the case also in a lot of photographic enterprises, such as the one that Edward Curtis carried on in 20 volumes, where he photographed and interviewed all tribes of Northern America. He also created a musical about the idea of the vanishing race. I'm going to give you a couple of more examples because I think it gives you the idea of how present this was. Another book made for Wanamaker store, which was a big store in New York, in Philadelphia. And in this book, you have also plenty of images of Native American being said as vanishing. And as you have so many images of people alive, you had this fantastic final with horses empty. So basically, now they are gone. So this kind of rhetoric, which is half funny and half depressing, was quite everywhere. So intellectuals, Native American intellectuals were very aware of that and responded actually to that idea of vanishing race. They were, I think we might not know that, or it took me a long time to realize, but they were very present, specifically in the East Coast, and they were publishing, writing, giving speeches. Here is something coming from Charles Eastman, who's a Sioux. And he's presenting his own book. You have to look at the title, The Indian Today, so another kind of title, The Past and Future of the First American. So quite a strong statement and a different one. It has a future, and it is the first American. It is the aim of this book to set forth the present status and outlook of the North American Indian. In one sense, he is a vanishing race. In another, an unequally true sense, it is a thoroughly progressive one, increasing in numbers and vitality, an awakening to the demands of a new life. So Native American intellectuals were taking position, and I think that's the context in which we can interpret Arthur Parker's dioramas. So the first thing to be said is that for the museum, where he's an anthropologist, Arthur Parker chose not to represent tribes from the Southwest, but certainly the tribes that were there. So basically the Iroquois. And the first diorama he created is this one, called the Horticulture Group. And I'm very tempted to interpret that as a quite strong statement. Because it might so perhaps been somehow reminded that corn was very important for the Iroquois, and even more so, Arthur Parker is obsessed about corn and the culture of corn, and he's writing almost all his scholarship about that. And I think that it has a precise meaning and a precise intention, being somehow a response to an argument that has been also carried on about colonization, explaining that it was totally okay to somehow occupy the land because the land was not occupied. Basically, these people were everywhere but nowhere, and they were not cultivating. So this is the meaning of the quotation that I found for you here. Indians should no longer be permitted to usurp for the purpose of barbarism the fertile lands, the products of mine, the broad valleys, etc. So I have the intuition that choosing as a main topic for dioramas and scholarship, agriculture was a kind of political option. And I'm just giving you one example from coming from Arthur Parker, very vast, actually, a publication list, where he's saying that Senecas, one of the Iroquois tribe, had long been farmers on an immense scale, so you have to understand, as is attested by all the French and English explorers who came among them. So he's really trying to make a point in his scholarship, and I think in his dioramas, that the Iroquois were occupying the land. And at multiple occasions, he will suggest a continuity between Iroquois and the present people living in these lands and cultivating these lands. And he's suggesting not only a continuity of land occupation, but also a continuity of value. Not with this picture, of course. That is an earlier picture. And these are not Iroquois, but Mohicans, but it gives you I guess a pretty strong insight in representation of people from the New York State, let's say, in Connecticut. In that case, aggressing a woman, a white woman, even better. And I think that Arthur Parker tried to create others, other representation, as it is the case in this diorama. And the scene is not super clear, but what you learn from the publication of Parker, because he wrote very short label, he's explaining you that warriors are coming back from war, and that the woman that you see, that you can see there, is pleading for the prisoners to be adopted and not tortured and not violated. So it's kind of another representation from what we were used to be at the time from the Iroquois. The Iroquois have been said to be very aggressive people, by the missionaries, of course, and by the settlers, to be very aggressive people and to have a very high and sophisticated practice of torture, which might be certainly true, but this is not at all what Parker is representing in the diorama. In the diorama, he's pleading in favor of some more gentle tradition, that is the one of adopting captive. And in order to conclude this first part, I just wanted to point out a document from the archives that I found. There are a lot, actually, of documentation. That's quite amazing. And he's trying really to make the point that, I'm just going to quote him, the Confederacy of the Iroquois, or the Six Nations, was the finest achievement in native culture and aboriginal democracy. Not also the word democracy, which is still today an important word in the political rhetoric. So he's trying to say, these people are not exactly what you think that they were, but they were rather a democracy, so something that the United States can also relate to, and the finest form of it. Then he's saying that this fact is not as widely recognized as it should be, and to the present time, no adequate history of the remarkable Aboriginal culture has been written. So basically, he's trying to emphasize the fact, and he's asking Mourinho in that letter, the fact that this diorama will serve as a non-written history of the people it belongs to. And then you have this word reliques that come back a number of times. I try to underline them. And reliques were somehow describing in this context the objects themselves he has in his collection, but also I guess, even a little bit the position. What I try to say is that I think he's negotiating his own position in these dioramas, and that his negotiation is based on a big context and also on prior negotiation. And I just emphasizing one quote of his grandfather, is also a very important speak person and intellectual, Nicholson Parkers, and he's talking, he's giving papers, conferences in Albany, and he tries to somehow meet his audience, saying, "Oh, I'm not an orator, I'm just an Indian, a relic of the wreck of the Iroquois that were before in your empire state." So basically, and I'm very happy to hear you on that, and specifically the medievalist, I think he used the idea of relic as a way to describe the objects, but also somehow as a position in history. We are a relic, and we are a relic of what you are today. But still we are alive, and still we are producing things. You have that, and I'm going to end up with that, but this first part. Is in mentioning that the Iroquois history is the most romantic period in the history of the state. So most romantic already, it's quite amazing. And then in the history of the state, so we are part of the history of the state. And so was also saying Nicholson Parker, your empire state. So I emphasize that dioramas were made through contact. And it's the case. And contacts mean here at least two things: physical contacts through plaster and bodies, and also through paint and skin, as we will see. This is the sense of the three words I have here: science, violence, and presence. So this contact created dioramas, but this contact also has other implications. This is my suggestion. They were, first of all, the guarantee that this was scientific in the sense of the 19th or early 20th century, in the 19th or 20th century sense of the term. They were also very violent, as we will discuss. And finally, they have some afterlife, and we will see that this afterlife is quite positive somehow, in the sense that they keep something from the presence of the people that have been casted or painted. So many casts, including the one I've been taking the photograph of, I found plenty of casts in the Museum of Natural History in New York, but like thousands. Most of them were taken there at the St. Louis exhibition in Missouri in 1904. They were taken by Caspar Meyer, the sculptor I mentioned. And this was a particularly intense place because it's united in what has been called the anthropological building. It's united scholars, anthropologists, artists, Native American visitors, and a lot of other people represented it in what is called here villages, and was, of course, very scary and violent gathering of people united in somehow, reunited there in order to perform traditional activities. So two different parts, the villages, but also the anthropological building, and people circulating all over the places. That must have been very intense. And anthropologists and artists took occasion to really realize a lot of life cast in this context. So it's a little bit how it looks like. I don't know if you can see, but Caspar Meyer signed them. So CM, you have it quite. Anytime he did something more than just a cast, or a bust, or a mannequin, entirely he signed it with his name, CM, Caspar Meyer. And also he painted them. Generally he painted them himself, but sometimes he had a painter working with him. And it's also interesting just for me, but the colors have been changing through time. So the colors that you see now, nowadays, are quite different from what they were probably at the time. So casting was something, color was another thing, and they were obsessed by having the most precise color scheme possible. And Boas really is asking, because the cast and the color was done for dioramas, but also more generally for anthropological research. And it's a letter from Rudolf Kronau, another German painter, who's much more than a painter, he's doing a lot of things. And he's proposing in this letter a solution to Boas, saying, "Oh, I got the perfect idea. I know what we're going to do. I'm going to take a sheet of white paper, I'm going to do a hole, and I'm going to try the color directly on this people's skin so I can compare and have the perfect match. So, and he's writing in German, which is also quite interesting. It's really a private thing between him and Boas. And then Boas will develop it as a technique later. That's not something I'm going to discuss, but the expertise of the artist and the interchangeability of knowledge between anthropologists and artists is quite amazing, but that's for next year. Thematic. And of course, that was made in a very dissymmetrical context with a power relation that is enormously unbalanced. But even when it was made in Albany in a more quiet setting somehow by Arthur Parker, some violence came up. Not only was violence part of the moment of casting, but even of the casting itself. Here you have, it's a beautiful quotation because Arthur Parker has this interest of recording how the model reacted. And if you read his papers, you will find a lot of, that's something that we don't have so much in this kind of history. How did the people feel? How did they react? And here you have a good example of that. One unknown Daga woman whose face I was casting lost confidence just before the plaster hardened and clawing it from her head rushed to a watering trough, scolding me the why for conspiring with the government to transform her into a white woman. So you have, it's interesting, you have the, you really have the, first of all, the fact that it's Arthur Parker who's doing the cast. So Arthur Parker is the anthropologist, but still is the one who's casting. No artist. And then you have the reaction of the woman who's suspicious. They were quite confident with Arthur Parker because he was born in the reservation. They knew him since he was a child. But there was this idea that the government, meaning Washington, was on them, and then she accused him to be part of that. And last but not least, the fact that because the plaster was white, she get confused and somehow panicked and thought, okay, oh my God, you want to whitening me. Which she didn't want. Representation of Native Americans is by no means a new thing. There is a long tradition of it in the 19th century sculpture, as much as after. And this is also an example from the sculpture of Malvina Hoffman that you might know, who's working for the museum, the Field Museum of Chicago, and she's intending to represent the races of man. And she's claiming, which is also very kind of topos, that she's not using a life cast, but she's only sculpting the idea of the people. So basically no close resemblance through mechanical reproduction, but a higher artistic position through finding the ideal type in the race and sculpting it and not casting it. Nevertheless, it's interesting to look at her archives at the GRI because that's a photo album that she realized with including her own production. And I found this bust inside of it. And it hasn't been included in the exhibition that she opened in the end of the 1920s. But it resembled quite a lot to that cast made by Caspar Mayer in 1904, and it's pretty believable that she somehow used it. And the point is not to say, oh my God, she's using a cast, but also to say these casts, these images that were made somehow disseminated themselves through time and were reproduced and reused quite a lot in different locations at different moments. This is also the case in the map she published. So here you have the same person. So not only a dissemination through the same medium, but also through print afterward. And that's my own interpretation, but I found that's a contemporary display at the American Museum of Natural History, and I think it quite resembles as well. So I have the impression that this cast and this history is somehow still at stake and still part of what we see today, and that the casts themselves are reproduced and reproduced and reproduced. And you probably all know about Walter Benjamin and his idea that the most something is reproduced, the less power or aura it has. And here you have something else. It because it has this original contact, because it has been made through contact somehow, the fact that this is a reproduction gives him an immense power and allows it to be reproduced. Just show something from Hans Belting to make that point clear. Now, it was not the original body, but an authentic imprint of it that propagated itself. This is a little bit the feeling that I have with my images, that they are still working in the public space. So much so, actually, that these dioramas have been dismantled. And it's interesting that this one, who's named the Iroquois Industries, but that actually represents more the Oneida tribe, has been given back to the Oneida Cultural Center. And they dismantled the diorama, but they care for it very much, actually, and they reframed people separately, and they relabeled them. And they explained to me, because I went, that they didn't care about the diorama, they didn't care about Parker, but they really do care about the people that have been represented, that these people are or were their grandmother. And because you have this imprint, this original imprint, and also, it must be said, the presence of real her, it is much more than a representation, it's portrait. So somehow, that was my last idea with the word presence. Somehow, even through the violence of the object and its history, it has today another function that is a real portrait. And this is how they are perceived and how they are cared for. And this is my last point, the idea of touch. In order to construct these dioramas, okay, the point is dioramas have been created in order to display artifacts. But it must also be said that in order to create this kind of disposition, you sometimes have to create artifact. It's not only a display that exhibits something, it's also an exhibition that implies new clothes, new shoes, even in that case, the house, because you didn't have exactly what you needed for each representation. So you had to make them somehow. The museum had to make them. The Museum of American History does that. Here you have the sculptor Sigourney Andros, who's also coming from Europe. I must say there is a really European trend in that sculptural milieu. He's reproducing the artifact. He's doing the mannequins, and he's reproducing the artifact. Arthur Parker had another strategy. He asked Native American women to redo the objects. So he made them come in the museum and ask them to be the one who were doing the artifact he needed for his show. And as they were there, and that's quite funny, he also asked them to pose as models. So the woman you have here, who's coming years after and has been photographed in this diorama, she was already in the diorama, because when she was young, she has been casted. So basically, here you go. And that's also something we have to understand about museum. There is a very pragmatic moment inside of it all. So what did Caspar Meyer wanted? He wanted a specific embroidery hair with mousse, because that was a very Iroquois traditional method, and that method was disappearing. People in the reservation were in a very, very poor state condition, physically and economically, and the tradition and the arts and crafts were really going down at the beginning of the 20th century. So much so that some of them were disappearing. So Caspar Meyer asked women to do this technique that was really specifically Iroquois and that he really wanted to be conserved. The problem was that many of these techniques have been really lost, and they didn't know actually what to do. So Caspar Meyer is writing to one of the women, Julia Cruz, and he tells her, well, mousse hair embroidery is not difficult. We have samples of the work which plainly show the method, if you know how to prepare, blah, blah, blah. So the museum objects somehow were the place where you could relearn the skills that he wanted the Native American women to do. So they had to come back to the museum to observe the objects. And second part of the quotation, he really wanted Native American women to do that. There are a good many French women in Canada, just north of us, who know to do the work about which I'm speaking, but I much prefer to have an Indian woman do it. So quite precise about who was supposed to also do the work. I've been wondering, and part of that is certainly his activist profile and the fact that he wanted to revigorate the arts and crafts. But part of it is also, I guess, the fact that he wanted the objects being genuine, and he's really constantly saying that it has to be genuine, genuine, genuine. The cast are to be genuine life cast of Iroquois. Their costume, genuine Iroquois costumes, Iroquois made and decorated. And I've been wondering why he was saying genuine, and not authentic or something like that. And I checked the Oxford Dictionary, and I've learned that the etymology of genuine is something about genou, so the knee, and that people from the 16th century had a traditional practice, apparently. When a child was born, the father take the child and put him on his genou, and the physical contact between the child and the father somehow show and demonstrated the filiation and the relation. So there is something of that. He really wants the objects being touched by the proper people. And that's what gives them their genuinity, in opposition to the reproduction that has been made in the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And I'm about to conclude. Native American women were not the only one who were studying Native American objects in the museum. This is a show that has been brilliantly and very beautifully analyzed at the board. These objects were exhibited in the Museum of Natural History in 1919. And they were also put into relation to that new production, because Native American objects and culture and visual style, if you want, was used and interpreted as a way to revigorize American textile and in order to create an American style. So basically, to make textile production after World War I purely American, Native American objects were used as an inspirational source starting at that moment, 1919. And then you have this old story that you probably all know of exhibition of Native American objects into art museums such as MoMA with René Darnoncourt, and you have this story taking really a stronger speed about re-evaluation of Native American production and also use of Native American production in a contemporary American context. So to image, to conclude, the diorama has been dismantled and the story is complex, because it would be too simple to think that all these objects have finally been recognized as art and have been exhibited at the MoMA or Metropolitan Museum. Starting 1990, as you might know, a series of laws have been discussed in America, legal laws, and multiple objects have been given back to American tribes. And this is the case with the mask that you cannot see, because when I asked for the photo, the picture of these dioramas, they told me, no way, we don't want you to see the mask. And I was like, okay, let's find a way, like a middle solution, and to say, okay, we're gonna black them for you, so you can have them and you can exhibit them, but you cannot see them. So this is the meaning of this picture, and that's my last slide. But the tradition, yeah, the thing is that it continues. Native Americans are still using dioramas as a powerful tool, and this is me listening to my audio guide as a good visitor and learning about what I'm saying. And this has been created at the Mashantucket Pequot Museum, so museum from the Mashantucket Pequot tribe in Connecticut. They also have a casino, it must be said. And yeah, well, but that cost money. And then they entirely created and funded a museum which is entirely made of dioramas, in which you can enter and circulate. Voilà, this is it.
Thank you, Noemi, for this very interesting insight and overview of American dioramas. And we're having a 10-minute break, and we'll come back for a Q&A. Thank you. So welcome back. And I again would like to thank Noemi for this very interesting insight, but also another lookout for next year's theme, art and anthropology. She bridged it with materiality and anthropology in a very nice and interesting way. So especially for those of us who are actually reading all those applications right now, and there are some of you in the room here, so that was a very nice addition. And John would like to start with a question.
I'm gonna take notes, so go for it. Yeah.
The people who visit.
Yeah.
Anyway, my question is, what about the subjects of these dioramas of American Indians? What we've seen so far is all the peaceful Indian doing basket weaving or whatever. What about the other side, the warlike side? Is that ever presented or not?
Good question. Not so much. Certainly not in anthropological museums, which was my target. It's a little bit more present in the fairs. But what is really present, it's not dioramas, but it's connected, it's what's called Wild West shows. And that is battles between Indians and cowboys and very aggressive things. So that is the way it's reenacted. Dioramas, not so much. As far as I know. Perhaps just a footnote about that. Arthur Parker, first wife, ended up in Hollywood being an advisor for a Wild West show because she was a, so the cultures are connected. It's a very complex mix of people, but not so much violence in the dioramas I've seen so far.
But I mean, is there any discussion way back about the types of dioramas, what kind of subjects they want to show, and that sort of thing? Is there a literature on that particular topic of what should be shown?
Yeah, so the first idea is that that's coming from Boas. You have to explain these objects. So basically we have that, we don't know what it is. We have thousands of that. We are going to create a diorama to explain what it is. But the diorama might be showing that like that. I'm not saying that it really explains, but that's the way it's perceived. Second, Native American arts and craft were a big target starting 1910. We want to demonstrate these people doing that. For many reasons, political, economical, and social. And yes, that's more or less the discussion you have. Not so much about the iconography as we intend it, as far as I know, but again, it might be other sources.
I was just wondering whether they were projecting onto the Indian the way they wanted Indians to be.
But every representation is that. Yeah, representation is about projection, that's for sure. They were projecting Indian as being for something that is always happening is a very clear gender separation. Women are doing that, men are doing that. So that's something that is very much discussed, but it's also something that is discussed in the American society, white society at the time. So yes, it's a projection with different fictions. And that's the difference of the fiction I try to emphasize a little bit. I think that there exists, but it's an interpretation.
Moment in which there, one might say there's a punctum. They seem like photographs of something that's stilted and still or stayed. And so how the specificity of what it means to photograph a diorama could act against what was happening with photography with Evan Curtis or other people.
Okay. So I think there is something that I completely I haven't addressed, and that's the question of photography as reproduction, because casting imprints are also photographs. In a way, I didn't address it because that's the main way to discuss diorama in relationship to photographs and to performances. That's the main common way to address it in the literature. What you said about photograph look like a scene, is that what Tsujimoto is working about? That's also why I took this picture, in a way just to make it like, first of all, okay, there is something very fascinating about this photograph that looks like a real scene. I don't think that the photographs of dioramas that I showed, for instance, this one, were in any way intending to, the photographs themselves, were in any way intending to counterbalance Edward Curtis' thing. I don't see any competition. What it has been, that comes from the museum in Albany, and it has been used as postcards. This is the basic way. Many, many things were printed in postcards. I think that why they were done originally. Perhaps to add a little more comment on photograph, something that must be said is that the artists who are casting and thinking the colors and so on are also doing photographs. And this is Caspar Meyer, so the sculptor, he's also a photographer. He's not a photographer, but he's taking photographs. He's going to Coney Island and he's photographing the Indian. So it's quite intricate, in a way that I don't exactly know what to say, except that there is a similarity in the close imitation. Because I'm happy. I'm taking notes.
Next one was Paris, then Bert, then Claudia, and then Sean.
My question already came up.
Okay, Claudia is off. Paris.
Well, first of all, thank you. It's really great, really interesting. And I have two interrelated questions. One might be completely obvious. I'm completely ignorant of the two dioramas, and I was wondering if there's any connection that you would see or that is established kind of to waxworks earlier on, because you get people like that, so replicating people, contemporary figures, or people who are doing images that people have lived in the past, attempting to present what they look like in a completely accurate way and to teach history, or just kind of give people the opportunity to be aware of these figures and to interact with them in that way. And I wonder if there's any relation. I mean, it gets big in the early 1800s, it's right before the diorama. And relatedly, I was wondering if part of the experience there is to be able to kind of promenade with these figures and be in court and see the king and queen or see the death mask of Louis XVI. And I was wondering how much interaction was, I guess, ever encouraged or possible in the diaries you studied. You know, if people could walk amongst them. I mean, you could in your own picture. And that's encouraged today in like a new kind of educational interactive environment. But whether that was part of the history at all.
Yeah, so a couple of comments. Certainly a big relation to waxwork. The first, so to speak, diorama, and I'm not sure we can really call it a diorama, but that I have found, was created in Versailles in the end of the 18th century. It was life-casted wax figures of Indians from Canada in order to teach to the children of the kings and the monarchy how to What were their new positions? So 18th century first, it's already anthropological, it's already life casted, and it's already in internet to show objects, but it's in wax.
Yes, it comes from anatomy.
Yes, yes, and that has a very long story from the Renaissance. The second thing is that somehow it's also interesting to know, for instance, that in the wax museum in the Musée Tussaud, I guess it was in Paris. They, so it is waxworks, but they also bought real artifact as the baignoire, what's the name, the bathtub of Mara. If they wanted to show some authenticity, show they both and put it, so you have that. And in terms of, basically the question you're asking is a big one that I don't know much about, is the reception of them at the time. That's an enormous thing, and I have no source, so I will have to manage with that. I don't think you could enter, but I know about one experience at the Museum of Natural History, where a child is saying that he's going into the canoe and he's really playing in Indian, and we are in the 1905 or 6. So some of them, I don't know if legally or illegally, but you might have been able to enter them. That being said, reception is a big question, and a very important one for any argument, of course. Okay.
There's a question, though, and that is, these four terms all seem to speak to, well, touch and contact and encounter, and it seems that one of the fascinating things about a diorama is a disjuncture where there's no contact or where there's some kind of a gap, and one way to kind of think of that gap is a media kind of gap between the painting in the back and the dirt on the ground or the artifacts or then again the sculpted bodies and then again the glass of the case and the frame, the wooden frame, and then again the sort of virtual space within the diorama and the presumably the space of reality outside. And there's, I guess, a slightly maybe darker side to the story of diorama than what might have been the pronounced tone of your talk, and that is that this disjuncture is one that does a violent disservice to the reality of the people that were represented. And that side might be somewhat elided by the use of photographs, particularly Sugimoto and maybe the early photographs as well, because those photographs tend to synthesize and erase these gaps and these disjunctures and make it seem like reality. I think that was one of Sugimoto's intentions in that photograph. So I just wondered, like, what you might think about that, these disjunctures.
Perhaps to begin with the most sensitive and perhaps the most important thing about the violence, more generally, perhaps it needs to be made much clearer. The dioramas I focused on are the one who are a little bit less violent than the enormous mass of representation. I just choose a body of work that for me is more interesting and also just simply unknown. I don't know if you ever have heard about that, but really they don't exist. And it must be said that this is an exception. It's not the only one. I have other examples we can discuss from other communities, Black American, African American, but it's very rare. And the violence is the most common thing happening. About junction and disjunction, I'm sorry if you don't find them to be well done, because the point was really not to create a sense of junction inside the representation between the first thing, the second thing, and the background. It might not work, but that was at least the intention in the creation, was to create something homogeneous, not disjuncted. And then just in order to finish that, I think what I'm trying to do, and this might be also just an effect of my sources, as we say in French, en effet de source, is that I'm speaking about the making, because this is what I know. And in that case, the making is about contact. And in many cases, it's about contact. You were perhaps mentioning the reception. It's another perspective, which is as valuable. But as I have no sources, I think my sources make me think about the making, much more about the reception. Contact is really much there in the making. And then And that's also perhaps the beauty and the fragility of the objects. It's violent, it creates a sense of being away, being isolated, but it's all about contact, though. I think there is a fiction of this, oh, this is far away. I think that's in some part of the violence, I don't know if I'm clear, but some part of the violence is also in the fiction that this is far away, because that was not far away. The people were there, they were writing, they were talking. So I think, yeah, was I clear? Quite. Okay. Disjunction is a fiction, I guess. I will note that one.
I had. The other thing was, and with that, I mean, this came up actually when I was speaking with Susan, but is animation, is that something that you really come up in your talk? Because it's, you said that they're seen as relatives and as ancestors, but I think you also find that, like, in many indigenous languages, the distinction is not between gender, but between what is animate and inanimate. And so we do not see these things as being, you know, said that they're dead, but they might actually be very alive. And I wondered who these were in fact made for. I mean, we can say the obvious answer is they were made for people who were living then in these museums, but because of this kind of, because of how embedded they seem, I wondered if they weren't meant to last much longer and carry on the language or carry on something more. Mm-hmm.
A little bit before, but yeah.
Also,
So yeah, super helpful. I just wrote a lot of keywords, and that gives me entries that I would be happy to explore. Perhaps just quickly a couple of things. Teaching, absolutely, and that comes already from, of course, Boaz, who says it's about having fun and learning.
I don't mean like didactic. I mean like
okay. Yeah. Something I've been discovering, and it's quite surprising, and perhaps it's also disturbing, is that Arthur Parker identifies himself and has been really learning from another very important anthropologist, who's Henry Lewis Morgan. It's 1851. He's publishing a book called The League of the Iroquois. And rather, I'm afraid, and that's the complexity of the story, rather than going back to the field to learn from the people where he's born, he's also taking directly very much from Morgan. So what you have is no direct affiliation in the Native American tradition, I think, although it's certainly completely there, but also coming from Morgan. And Morgan, maybe it's going to confuse you, but Morgan have been taught by Arthur Parker's grand-uncle. So Ellie Parker is a diplomat Seneca. He speaks a lot to Henry Lewis Morgan. And then Henry Lewis Morgan published his book, and then Arthur Parker go back to this book because he's self-taught. So see, the that's one thing that might be said. About having people talking to me about the dioramas, that's a great idea. I really want to. The only thing I have been told is about this one, but it already like just completely opened my eyes. There is something about time. I keep saying that, and people told to me at the Oneida Cultural Center, well, but this is confusing because these people are dressed like prehistoric people, but they are doing 19th century activities. So what's this image anyway? They were really, really reading it as, and I was like, of course, yes, there is a problem of time actually. When are we? Because they are dressed like prehistoric style, but they are doing the activity they were told to do in the reservation for tourist business. Not that they were not doing it before, but this is a big, so clearly insightful. And I was like, oh my God, now I understand something more. And perhaps this last thing about corn. Corn is certainly much more than everything I know about it. I really do believe it. Just wanted to show you, it's also used very much in the diorama in the Machin Touquet. They also really emphasize the cultivation of corn because their right to exploit their land for casino purpose has been criticized. And the old diorama is showing, yeah, we were there before. Look at, we were in this landscape and we were cultivating corn. So that's also the way I perceived it because I was comparing somehow the two dioramas. But thank you very much. It's a lot to discuss. Yeah. But does that invalidate somehow the political meaning, you think?
Well, I think it's both things. I think
No, yeah, I agree.
I think it's also like this is like their poor image.
It's because it's everywhere, of course, outside dioramas as well. In paintings, Native American paintings, they use it quite a lot. Layers are multiple.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's a great question. It helps me. It makes me. It gives me the opportunity to say something. And the answer is yes, you do, very much so. Yeah, very much so. They are used even to commemorate some events. I know that some religious group ask for diorama to be built, reenact their own history, but it can be a history quite close in time. So yes. In Scandinavia, it's almost only used in order to display folk's culture. Yeah, which is already somehow far away, but not completely. You have them au Musée du Trocadéro in Paris. They are used to represent peasants. So it's about the self. It's about the other. It's also about the self. So it's a complex object in that sense. And I think that these dioramas somehow play on that. It's the other, but it's the self. And it's not very clear what you have. So good question. Thanks for asking it, because I forgot to say it. Say it again, the rhetoric of what?
It's like a sort of a sightedness. Sightedness,
right? Okay.
The soil being something, this autochthonous that, you know, is belongs to a certain place, right? And that may be either arid and unusable or maybe is very fertile. And especially with this parallel rhetoric about, you know, whether or not, you know, these native peoples are allowed to, like, you know, stay in their land and use it because they're not. There's just an interesting kind of.
Yeah, so it's not. It's a great comment and it's very useful. So I just word it and I will explore that. He's not referring about archaeology in any way, nor about fecundity in any way. I don't know where he has this idea from. He doesn't say so, but he somehow set it up a standard for anthropological relevé that Boas proposed. So that's also something I have said and I have not been emphasized, is how much the artist changed some anthropological practices and the other way around. That's a very fascinating topic. Although, of course, there are like modest artists that must be also acknowledged. But still, he's not thinking about fecundity. The only very somehow related but a little bit funny and also scary comment is that in 1904 he organized Olympic game for everybody at the fair, and the Native American, I don't know which tribe, but a group of them won the Olympic games. And then you have them being, the Germans being a little bit like, oh my God, they won the game, the competition. So you have something about who's the best that's certainly at stake, not related to soil as much as I know. But then I need to perhaps check a little bit more of his own background. And he's going to be an explorer, and then he's going to left and be a guy who's going to travel in the Southwest and write books, travel books, and so on. So quite a complex person.
I was kind of going to ask a question that you've been asked, but I'm going to ask a slightly different question. Mm-hmm. How is it that this works? What does it do? How does it operate? Who is the viewer? I mean, it's both perception and making.
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. It's also an enormous topic. Maybe but it's good. I will try to answer as much as I can, and I can also connect that to Patch, because there is some topic that have not been addressed, and you know, I think it's quite an elephant in the room. It's the question of race, because I've not been talking about race specifically, but this is what it is about. It's measurement, it's color. That's really an enormous thing. And so that's also what the World Fair is about. And dioramas, it's a great question in the sense that my answer will be complex. I think dioramas are, in a way, part of this entertaining culture. And they are also close to the Wild West show and the villages somehow. But something I've been noticing, and that maybe I'm maybe giving too much credit to my object of study. But for instance, if you take the World Fair in Paris in 1900, you had dioramas of African, not really dioramas. No, voilà. You had like village of African people. So to be clear, people gathered, exploited, and exhibited in poor condition, but also paid and performing at some place. So complex. You had that, and you had dioramas of African American people created by African American people under the supervision of Du Bois, which is not a small guy, and so you had two visions of Africas, if you want. One is where the African for Africas performing in villages, and the other one where African Americans, very educated, very much in control, and they use dioramas. So that's something I've been discovering by you. The two cultures are not, it's not just a linear history, oh, dioramas come after. It's a simultaneous history, and sometimes it's opposite display, although they look quite the same. And sometimes it's displays that were used in as site of self-representation. Let me also just say that in the Jamestown Fairs in Virginia in 1907, you have this diorama that I showed you at the beginning, but you had also a building called the Negro Building, where African Americans were stuck somehow, and they also used dioramas to represent themselves, their history based on slavery, but also on emancipation. So to draw the bigger picture, they might be used there are tools, and they might be used differently, but they may also be used in a nice, resisting way. They are also a place of resistance, which is a total surprise and which is unnoticed in the historiography. I wanted to show the diorama, but whatever. I don't find it anymore. The Native American one of 1907, but you remember it. The first encounter, don't you? That's it. In the same fair, at the same moment, you have these dioramas and you have African American dioramas made and controlled by African Americans representing the emancipation of slavery. Why I am not showing them to you? Because they don't exist anymore. Because also I'm dealing with an object that has a short life somehow. Because it has been thrown away, or because it has been judged creepy later, unfortunately.
I don't know your name, but you're sitting next to Susanna.
Richard.
My question sort of follows on some of the other questions here, and I guess what it really comes down to is wondering, and maybe you don't know the answer to this yet, but is your project more about dioramas as paradigmatic of the representation
Attends, say it again, sorry. So much energy. Okay.
Or is it the other way around? Are we interested primarily here in looking at representations of Native Americans, and the diorama tells us something, you know, kind of special about that kind of representation? Why these things?
Mm-hmm.
And to kind of follow on with that also, I think one thing that, you know, some of these questions that we've had, you know, bring up is that there's a definition issue, like our sacral monti. Are the ethnographic exhibitions from like the 1911 Italian National Exhibition, where you have all the different regions of Italy's, you know, primitive huts kind of represented and things like that, and you could go into them. And those are, you know, representations by Europeans with their own history. So, you know, it's a lot of different politics with that than there is with the ones you're talking about. So I suppose the question is, like, how big is the canvas for?
Yeah, but I think people who are interested in dioramas have somehow give up on a precise single definition that you can apply to everything. It's a bit like book, you're okay with multiple options. I mean, it can be different thing. So I'm not gonna excite myself too much, but the question of what I'm doing exactly, where I am going, is a great question, of course. And to tell you the truth, sometimes I oscillate between writing a monography on Arthur Parker, diorama in Albany, and doing the history of all dioramas, all time, all period, all style. It's probably going to be something in between. But you know what's interesting in art history or in science is that sometimes your object makes you think and makes you redefine what you're doing. And that's what I'm hoping. My question is much more, what can this diorama make to me or makes to art history? How can art history do something for dioramas, and how can diorama do something for art history? I think that's my goal. That's where I'm seeing it. That's unclear, but at least it's ambitious and fun. But yeah, no. Yeah. The role of what?
Of Theodore Roosevelt.
Okay.
Because he actually was, at the time, he was very impatient at the State Museum and pretty much predicted the end of Native American culture. He said it was inevitable. Yeah. So he wrote the preface, sorry. So I was just trying to remember. I'm sorry, I forgot the number. But basically, he also, though, was engaged in the building, specifically in the building. Mm-hmm. I mean, to a terrible degree, I think even by hunting standards, but then he also was very much engaged in an ecological movement.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these things, they are interrelated, but they also conflict a little bit, I mean, from our contemporary point of view. So I don't know if these are things that...
Yeah, no, for Roosevelt, it's connected to that. I think that's one of the arguments that Donna Haraway makes. She connects, because they are friends, actually, in Roosevelt, they are hunting together. So she basically connects their ideologies and their will to preserve the specimen, to hunt, to kill it, and then to preserve it in a taxidermic form very much. So nothing to do very much with my Albany diorama, but somebody who's interesting is the wife. Eleanor Roosevelt, because she will be writing the preface again of Indian art in the United States, and that's another moment where she's saying it. If you read the preface, it's amazing. She's saying like something that Arthur Parker could have said. Really, she's saying like Native American art is important. It's important for the future of America. It's important for economical reasons. So she's really taking that. I'm afraid that people want to leave because I know we have a shuttle, so I don't want to. Okay.
In terms of your focus on making, I was wondering if you were thinking about different approaches to making and sort of these different objects that are compiled in the panorama. So you have the idea of the making of the human forms through casting and sculpting.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the making of the artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like that's kind of the different approach to this making question.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe totally, and maybe just to finish, something have not been addressed is that there is a question of authorship. Because have you seen my label? I labeled like crazy, 5 lines. He did that, she did that. Labeling is already like part of the job, describing what it is. That's the first question. And at some point, there is really a conflict. Arthur Parker said, I'm the author, but the artist said, we are the author. So there is a big authority complex. Thank you.